Okay.
Recording it, unless I hear you're projecting.
Okay, welcome everybody. How was Yom Kippur? Was it okay? You were here, right?
Yeah.
I feel that was nice?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good. Okay, so here we go. We are moving from the Yamim Noraim, or the Yamei HaRachamim V'Slichot, as the Sfarim call it, to, I always find that interesting, no? The Ashkenazim call it Yamim Noraim, terrifying days, right? And the Sfarim say, Yamei HaRachamim V'Slichot, right? We're going to get forgiven, we're going to get mercy, it's all okay. Maybe that summarizes the difference between Ashkenazim and Sfarim. And we're moving into Zman Simchateinu. Even though there's a war going on around us, so hopefully we'll be able to gain some sparks of Simcha, even though it's tough times. What we want to try and do today, what I'd really like to try and do is to give us a sense of what it means spiritually to sit in the sukkah. That's really what we're going to aim to do. But the guise of this shiur, or the way I got into this shiur, was by trying to really understand what we mean when we say that the whole reason why we sit in Sukkot is because Hashem had us sit in Sukkot. So I'll just try and help go through a certain thought process together with you, and we'll see where we can take this and where we end up. So probably you all know the psukim from Vayikra Perek Chaf Gimel, which you see as the first sheet source in your sheet. It says, "V'chagotem ato chag l'Hashem shivat yamim b'shana chukat olam l'dorotechem b'chodesh shvi'i tachogu ato." It's in the seventh month. "B'sukot teishvu shivat yamim." You should sit in a sukkah for 7 days. "Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael yishvu b'sukot." Every citizen in Israel should sit b'sukot. By the way, that word ezrach is a very interesting word. Why is it used that? There's a place where it says ka ezrach, ka ger. What exactly does it mean, ezrach? When do you use the word ezrach? In modern Hebrew, by the way, ezrachut means citizenship, to be a citizen. All right? Literally, if you have a citizen's rights, if you have a citizen's status, you're an ezrach. Right? Otherwise, you are, I don't know, a czar, an alien, a foreigner, whatever you use that word. So, kol ezrach b'Yisrael yeshuv b'sukkot. Everybody's got to sit in the sukkah. L'mani yidu dorotechem. In all that your future generations will know, ki b'sukkot hashavti b'nei Yisrael, that I put b'nei Yisrael in sukkot, b'otzi otam eretz Yisrael, ani Hashem
elokechem. Yeah. Why is the qualification that you have to be like a citizen of Israel if the people that were in the desert, in the booths, didn't go into Israel?
But this is talking about that this will be Ledorot Echem for future times.
Like, if the original people didn't even go, they weren't even technically Israelites.
Okay, so I guess what you're relating to is this idea of a sense of, let's call it, historical continuity. You know, there's this strange thing that of peoplehood, right? And that even though I live many generations, thousands of years removed from those people, I still feel a sense of continuity. Their story is my story. And I think that's exactly when you say Leman Yedu Dorotechem, right? You're saying, wow, you know what? By continuing to do this, and I guess we do a Seder on Pesach, we sit in Sukkot, and thereby we say, okay, you're 100% right. Those people came out of Egypt, and the people came out of Egypt didn't go into Eretz Israel, and people in Eretz Israel didn't come out of Egypt. But somehow it was seen as one continuum, and we still see ourselves on that journey, right? Yes. And when I daven this morning, and I spoke about Kriyat Yamsuf, Hamavir Banabin Gizrei Yamsuf, and all that sort of thing, I see that as part of my story, and not a story of somebody somebody else. So, one second.
I'm just kind of curious about that. Why doesn't it say Jews?
So we never refer to as Jews in the Torah, okay? So we could say Kol Yisrael, right? So sometimes we'll have, Ata, Uvincha, Uvitecha, sometimes you'll have Ata, V'halivi, V'algera. You have to, we had a couple of weeks ago, Parsha. Atem nisamenu ayom kulchem lifnei Hashem elokechem, rashichem, shiftichem, ziknechem, v'shotreichem. You know, we've got some... The interesting question is, I just pointed out, what does Ezrach mean? So Ezrach Lechora means every Jew. Why it uses that word and how it uses it is a really interesting thing. And I don't know the answer. I actually happened to, just serendipitously, 3 days ago on Erev Yom Kippur, I was standing on the steps of my shul and talking with Rav Aviad Tabori and Rav David Nativ, who's one of my mentors in Tanakh, and talking about exactly this question. And we were trying to pin down, what does it mean, Ha'ezrach? And Rav David Nativ, who has been teaching Tanakh a lot longer than me and actually taught me how to be a Tanakh teacher, said, oh, it's a really interesting phrase, and I looked into that for months and years and I've never managed to sort it out. So that was really interesting. That this word is Ezra. Yes.
On that kind of that point, is it not referring to like Yaakov, like all of like this Israel here? It's not talking about the land, like.
What phrase are you referring to?
Because I thought Ella's question was Ezra, but Israel, like a citizen
in Israel.
In Israel, but not the physical Israel, like the children of Yaakov.
Yeah, yeah, the children of Yaakov. Call Ezra Israel in the people of Israel, B'nei Israel.
So then I don't understand the question.
Your question came from the fact that you were saying citizen of the country of Israel? Is that how
it was like a multi-part question.
Okay, whatever.
There were a lot of
sections. So just by the way, Eretz Israel is not really called Eretz Israel in the Torah either. It's called Eretz Canaan or Eretz Avachal Udvash or Eretz HaKanani Vagir Kashiva and Moriva. You know, Eretz Israel, the twin two words, Eretz Israel, appears three times in the whole of Tanakh, which is fascinating. You have Haaretz, you have lots of other things, but you don't have Eretz Israel a lot. Israel is more the people, and a couple few times you have Eretz Israel. Okay, so all right. So, with that little detour, we'll simply say that we're going to sit in Sukkot, so that we should know that our future generations should know. In all, the future generations should know that. Basukot Hoshavti, again, interesting phrase. I had your generation sit, how does it translate it here? I made the Israelites live in booths. Interesting. Hoshavti, I placed them, I seated them, I had them live. Like, how did that happen? What does he mean by that, right? Basukot Hoshavti et Bnei Israel, Potziotam Eretz Yisrael, Ani Hashem Elokechem. Interesting, Hashem really talking in the first person as well. But what's going on here? And probably, I imagine, you're probably familiar with this machloket, booths or clouds, right? Have you come across that today at all? It's a very famous one, right? That what exactly does it mean, right, that we have basukot or shavti b'nei Israel? There's a machloket between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva, okay? Rabbi Eliezer says, ananei kavod ayu, that really the sukkot, that God never gave us booths. Like, what does it mean? God had us sit in booths. He gave us the booths, right? What exactly is going on here? So that there are, that Hashem didn't give us booths, but how did he protect us? There's something called Ananea Kavod, right? And the other opinion is Rabbi Akiva, who says, Sukkot Mamasha Sulem. Actually, they all had Sukkot. Yeah. Right. So maybe it was more like a pergola. Right? Is that a word you're familiar with? An arbor, like you have like four things and then you put a shade and then you put all sort of leaves on the top, maybe palm leaves. No, maybe there weren't walls. That's what I'm trying to say. Maybe it was like a chuppah. More like a chuppah, right? Sometimes you'll find this on the beaches of Sinai. You'll find... Great, beautiful. So now we're learning that sometimes we have a concept which is a biblical concept. We have a concept which is a biblical concept. And sometimes we translate in the halacha in a different way. Okay, that might well be. Okay, and that's an interesting thing where we have a bit, it would be difficult to imagine that they all had enough wood to make walls. By the way, we did make one structure which actually did have walls. And that was the Mishkan, right? And it's fascinating that in a lot of, and we'll come back to it in a couple of minutes, right, that a lot of the, even halachot of the Mishkan, of the sukkah, come from the Mishkan. So for example, I'll just give you one example. They say, what's the minimum height of a sukkah? 10 tefachim, okay? 10 tefachim, and one of the sources for that is that the Aron HaBrit was 10 tefachim. Okay? What's the connection? I'm not sitting in the Aron HaBrit. Okay? Somehow there seems to be a connection somehow between the Mishkan and the Sukkah. Right? Whichever way, you're 100% correct. There are times, right, when we'll have a concept. I'll give you one other example. Well, there are lots of other examples, but one which comes to mind. In Sefer Shemot, it tells us, for example, that here's a sheet. Here, take.
Oh, thank you.
It says, when we're trying to remember Mitzrayim, it says, Vayu lo'ot al yadecha ulezikaron ben enecha. They should be as a sign on your hand and to a memory between your mind. Says the Ibn Ezra, this must be talking about tefillin. Says the Rashbam, no, it's not talking about tefillin. We need to remember something, we need to make a sign on our hand and something in our minds, but how do you do that? So eventually, we came up with tefillin. But actually, the pshat is not tefillin, right? The Ibn Ezra doesn't like gaps between pshat and halacha, but the Rashbam is quite comfortable with it, so... it's interesting how sometimes the pshat of Chumash might be one thing, and halacha we create a certain ritual, right? Give you another example. Uchtavtam al mezuzot beitecha avisharecha, right? Write it on the doorways of your house. So really, we should write the mitzvot on the doorway of Midrashat Lindenbaum, right? It should be there in the. But we don't. What we do is we write it on a scroll and put the scroll on the door. Right? It's interesting. The Samaritans, the Shomronim, right, actually have it carved on the stoneway above their doors, right? They have like a little plaque above their doors. So they'll have like a plaque with the words of Shema, I think, over the door, right? They literally write it on their doorways. We don't. We write it on a scroll and put the scroll on our doorways. How did that happen, right? So sometimes it can be that, you know, we translate things halachically in different ways than maybe they're written on peep shut. So even if, but the Torah says basukot, right? And then halacha will just figure out what's a sukkah. Okay, so what have we done so far? We've said, God put us in sukkot, and I don't know what those are. There are two options, okay? One is that we made the sukkot, and one is that God made the sukkot, okay? I once had friends of mine who always used to like to paint the walls of their sukkah every year, and one year they painted them with clouds, right? It was a whole cloud theme. They painted the whole outside of their sukkah with clouds. So we're sitting in the clouds. Which interpretation do you prefer?
Rabbi Eliezer.
Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, you prefer the clouds. Why?
Because it's more feasible.
What do you mean?
In the sense that it makes more sense that Hashem would be protecting us in the deserts, or like as Ella was saying, like they didn't really have the resources to build proper booths, so it would make more sense that it was Hashem protecting us,
wow,
rather than us making our own booths.
Okay, nice. So you're saying now. That's really interesting. So you're saying, because you have this sense of basukot or shafti, God did it for us, right? And also because they don't have the materials for so many people to have booths. So it makes sense. Hashem did it. So first of all, that's number one. And number two, that the materials aren't there. Right.
But it doesn't fit as well.
Right. Okay. So usually a sukkah would mean an actual shelter. Okay. And for example, we just read Yonah on Yom Kippur, and it says, "Vayas lo sham sukkah vayeshiv tachteh." He made himself a shelter and he sat under it, and then the story of the kikyon. So sukkah usually means an actual booth, right? So to say, I made sukkot, but the sukkot don't really mean sukkot, they really mean clouds. He should have said, I gave you clouds, right? And so that's a bit of a problem. Like, what's going on there? Yeah.
Could it be both, they made physical booths and God also protected them?
Maybe. So,
also, I know there's an idea that, when you build the sukkah, you're, you're recreating the Mishkan. So, why we do it now could be because of that. Recreating that, but they didn't actually do it.
So we're going to try and sort of excavate that idea and see where it sort of comes from, but we'll that'll be one of the ideas that we'll come to. Okay? Yeah.
So Hashem, He made Sukkot. He made protection for Bnei Israel in the desert where they didn't have resources. It could have just been protection, you know, the clouds. But in reality, clouds don't protect us in today's world. So today's world, what would protect us? You know, actual walls and a roof.
So I guess if you're in the Middle East, maybe clouds would be useful from the heavy sun, right? So maybe in a desert, you'd like be very happy when a cloud comes over and you get a bit of like shade. So I guess in that sense, if it's like, you know, Yomama Shemesh Lo Yakeka, right? If that's the protection you want, that the sun won't like beat down on you, that might offer some protection. But yes, you're right. Clouds don't protect us so much. Unless they're magic clouds, which we'll have to see. Yes?
Also, deserts aren't entirely without greenery. Like, there are trees. They're just, like, not all clustered together.
Right.
There's dry areas. So it could, like, presumably they just found a place that had wood.
Okay. So maybe... So we're going to follow the Ibn Ezra on this little journey here. Okay? And we're going to see how the Ibn Ezra tries to grapple with this. Okay? So let's just, first of all, say, if we go... Okay. So the first thing, and I don't know why the source is not in Hebrew, but somehow that got left off the sheet. But there's a mechilta here, which you see in English, right? That there were seven clouds. Can you see it in English? Sorry, clouds of glory. Four of them to each direction of Bnei Israel. One was above them and another below their feet. A further cloud would pass in front of them, leveling the valleys and flattening the mountains. Okay? You heard this tradition before?
Nope.
Okay, well, welcome. Okay, so there's this interesting midrash, okay? Now, so one of the reasons why you might not have heard about it is because you've been learning pshat, right? Is there an idea of clouds protecting Bnei Israel according to the pshat?
Yeah.
Say that again?
That's not
pshat. What? Say that again?
Like the cloud.
Just help me, what that I understand, I think I even know what that hand action is. But you're going to have to say it in words.
Like when they're leaving and a molly comes and then they shoot arrows.
So you're telling me that what this means is that they shot arrows and they went into the cloud and the cloud shot them back?
That's not pshat, though.
It's not pshat.
It does say in Kriyat Yamsuf.
Thank you. Kriyat Yamsuf. You're close. It's Parashat Bashal. But just a couple of prakim earlier. Okay, so first let's start off. What clouds... This is turning to be a fun class. Yeah. Okay. That's Kriyat Yom Suf, but the things are yeah. Okay. Okay, we're learning sign language. All right. So we all know, by the way, explicitly, right, that there is this notion of a cloud which led them out of Egypt. Right. There is what it's called. The Amud Esh and the Amud Anan, right? Do you remember that one? So you have a pillar of fire, a pillar of cloud. Where would you find that? Let's look at the beginning of Bashalach. Shemot Peret Yud Gimel. Oh, you don't have Shemot, you don't have a Tanakh in front of you? Fine, I'll read it to you. Okay? Shemot Peret Yud Gimel. We have the idea that Vahi Bashalach Paro Et Ha'am, and it says, sorry, 1 minute. Vashem olech lifnehem yomam b'amud anan l'chotam aderech v'layla b'amud eish la'ir lahem l'echit yom v'layla. So, God led them with an amud anan, with a pillar of cloud, l'chotam, to lead them. What does that mean? That they wanted to know which way to go, so maybe the pillar of cloud, I don't know, maybe there was a pillar of cloud, and when they wanted to say we're going this way, it went this way, right? In other words, it pointed where to go, to lead them. Or it just went in front of the camp, and they follow that cloud, okay? Something like that. Okay, and apparently it also says here that v'layla b'amud eish la'ir lahem. At night they didn't travel; it's hard to travel at night. But at night they had street lighting through the amud eish. By the way, that's already fascinating that you have a cloud which maybe did the cloud like at night did it like light up with fire. There's frequently cases where God is represented by fire and cloud. Give me an example: fire and cloud with God. Har Sinai, where you have fire on the mountain and cloud. Although there is an anan, and then there's also smoke, right? Now, we always say there's no smoke without fire. So maybe the fire comes from the smoke, but the cloud is very different because cloud is really water, right? So that is two opposites, right? Interesting. Fire and water. Fire and water, fire and cloud. Also, by the way, and another place where you have fire and cloud in an interesting nevuah. What?
Together? Or like...
Yeah. Well, maybe smoke. Yeah.
Is it in your Miata?
Maybe, but remind me of a place.
The pot, is it smoke and fire?
No, the pot's bubbling.
Okay,
but... Masa Merkava, do you have Aish? And yeah, you might be right, Masa Merkava. I was thinking something in Sefer Bereishit, which is the Brit Ben HaBetarim. It says, V'hinei tanur ashan v'lapid Aish asher avar ben ha'gzarim ha'ele. That when God sort of passes between the pieces in the Brit Ben HaBetarim with Avraham Avinu, it says, V'hinei tanur ashan v'lapid Aish. Right, there's fire and smoke. Right, it's not quite smoke. But this idea that, by the way, you know, both smoke and fire are interesting things. They're both sort of like something real in this world, but you can like put your finger through them. You put your finger through a flame. Don't do that one at home by yourselves. But you never used to do that? We always used to do that. Okay? Maybe it's just boys. I don't know. Okay, there you go. So flame's a real thing, but you can put your finger through it. And cloud, right? You know, you fly through the clouds like they're real, but... So maybe there's this sense of something which is here, but not quite... I don't know. Anyway, fire and cloud represent God. There's a pillar of fire, a pillar of cloud. And it's meant to lead them, right? It's meant to lead them. Later on, by the way, the pillar of fire and pillar of cloud come back as being above the Mishkan. There's a cloud above the Mishkan. So it's interesting how this cloud serves different roles. In Kriyat Yamsuf, and this is what was mentioned before, there is a pasuk says, "Vayisa Malach Hashem." I'm reading from Perek Yudal, pasuk Yutet. "Vayisa Malach Hashem Ha'Elohim Ha'olech Lifnei Machane Israel." The angel of God who was going before Machane Israel, it says, "Angel of God," but what angel of God was there? So maybe it's the cloud. "Vayelech Me'achareihem." It went behind them. "Vayisa Amud Anan Mipneihem." The Amud Anan went from before them. The Yamod Me'acharehem, and it went behind them. Vayavo be'machane Mitzrayim, ve'machane Israel, and it separated the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. V'Anan va'choshech, and there was the cloud and the darkness. Vayaret alayla, and it lit up the night. V'lo karav zeh zeh kol alayla. So this is like a smoke screen, right? And that's where Rashi says, okay, but if there's a smoke, so why didn't they shoot? Why didn't they shoot arrows or some sort of ammunition at them? And then the answer is, well, either maybe they were just confused about where they were, right? Or the other option is, right, that it was magic clouds and it started bouncing things back, right? Okay? But that is what we know about the cloud. I'm just going to mention one other source, and I realize I should have probably put all these sources in the sheet, but I didn't. What? Now you're going to have to use your imagination.
If you want to say that, you know, God worked through nature, it could have also been a twister. In which case...
It could have been what?
A twister.
Oh, twister. Interesting.
In which case it would have one day arrow
back. Okay, interesting. And I'll just mention one other pasuk, right? From Bamidbar Perek Yudalet. Okay, and this is, I think, everything that the Torah actually tells us about the clouds. Okay, in Bamidbar Perek Yudalet, when Moshe's talking in the story of the Meraglim, he mentions the cloud, and he says to God, he says, Amruel Yosheva Haaretz Hazot Shamu Ki Ata Hashem Bekerv Am. The people of this land know that you are in the midst of the people, Hazeh, Asher Ayin Ba'ayin Nira Ata Hashem. You're visibly seen. People from Eretz Yisrael have already seen you. V'anancha Umeir Alehem. Because your cloud stands above them. Here we have the idea that Anancha Omed Alehem. And maybe this image, right, on the one hand they've got a cloud in front of them, they've got a cloud over them, they've got a cloud protecting them on the side, led people to come along and say that there were such things as Anane HaKavod, right, that there were some sort of clouds of glory. It's interesting they're called Anane HaKavod, right, because Anane HaKavod, I would think they're the Kvod Hashem, right? Whichever way, there's some sort of magic clouds which protect and maybe flatten things out. I guess also, if you've ever visited the Sinai Desert, there aren't areas where like 600 people can walk in formation. So if you want to hold that they traveled in formation, how does a camp of 600,000 people with, you know, Yehuda at the front and with Reuven in the south and, you know, the whole formation of the camp, how does it go? Well, somebody would need to flatten out the land, and suddenly we get this image of lots of clouds which sort of serve this protective And then there's also Midrashim, which we can add on to that. When Aaron died, the clouds went away. Okay. These are like Midrashim built on Midrashim. Yes?
Just to clarify, Anane
HaKavod
and whatever.
Amud HaEshvanan?
Yeah. Are they
being interchangeable? No. So let me try and explain my methodology. I'm a bit of a pshat guy, right? And I am trying to figure out, Anane HaKavod, where are those in the Bible, right? Okay, so I'm saying, hold on, let's see what I know about clouds. I know that clouds often represent God. When God appeared on Har Sinai, there was a cloud, there was fire. I know that God appears as cloud and fire in the Brit Ben Avtarim. Okay, all good. Hashem comes down, speaks to Moshe, the cloud comes down. How do you know God's here? The cloud appears, right? So the cloud represents God. Okay, we'll start with that. Number two, I know that there was a cloud of sometimes cloud and sometimes fire, which led the people. I know that in a certain situation, it protected them from behind. I also know from Perek Yudalad that it stood above the camp at some point. Maybe protecting them from the sun or just as a sign. That's what I know. Now, to jump from there to Anane HaKavod is quite a jump. Correct? That's where the Midrash comes in. The Midrash is sort of extrapolated from all this cloud stuff and said, there's Anane HaKavod.
Okay?
All right, you following the logic? Okay. Let's take a look at the Ibn Ezra, who's going to not be so sure about Anane HaKavod. Okay? You've got the Ibn Ezra, that is actually on your sheet. Okay? And you've got the final one. Okay. So, here we go. You see the Ibn Ezra? Okay. Ibn Ezra number 3. V'yesh b'kabloneinu sha'amru. Some of the earlier opinions, maybe the rabbi says, sheshiva anim hayu, and he quotes this Mechilta. Olafi dati, however, I disagree. Some of you might know, Ibn Ezra was very much, especially in the narrative segments of the Torah, very into pshat, whatever's written, and not what additional readings. And he says, Olafi dati, in my opinion, shnaim levadam, there were only two, Anane HaKavod. Gami tachem liot echad, and maybe there were only one. In other words, the Amud Anan became the Amud Esh. Okay, so there's really only one, there's not two. That Amud Anan can also protect them. And this is the reason why Tehillim, Perek Hey, which talks about the Midbar, says, Paras Anan Lamasach. It says that the Anan became a screen. Masach means a screen. Right? By the way, Masach, if you ever need to fix your screen, right? That's also a Masach, right? Okay. So, it could well be that the Amud Eish is inside the Amud Anan at night. Katam Eish Tier Laila Bo. And he says in these clouds, Imayu Shnaim, Hayu Im Yisrael Achia Vruateyam. Very interesting. The Ibn Ezra says, the Amud Anan, Amud Eish only were there till where they mentioned in the beginning of Beshalach and with Kriyat Yamsuf. They're not mentioned in Milchemet Amalek. They're not mentioned in all sorts of other things, right? And they only come back after the Mishkan. So he says, they were only with them till they crossed the sea. V'nissaku mehem al dati. And they stopped at that point. Ki ein sorach lalechet balayla achar shen nitba paro v'chelo b'yam. He says, we were in a big hurry to get out of Egypt to cross the border. Once we crossed the border and we extricated ourselves from the Egyptians, we didn't need to walk at night. We weren't in such a hurry. We could take our time. So we only have, first of all, Ibn Ezra rejects the notion that there were Sheba Ananim, right? And second of all, he's going to suggest that that they were only there for like the first week, for Pesach, basically. Ibn Ezra, in Shemot, also says something very interesting about this notion of Sukkot, etc. Let's just take a look here. By the way, we're going to see a line here. Im svarahi yesh levakesh derech acheret. The Ibn Ezra has a very interesting shita about midrashim. He'll frequently say, im kabalahi nekabel. If this is a tradition, we will accept the tradition. Im svarahi derech acheret yesh lanu. If there's a masorah that there was a certain thing, I accept masorah. But he says, I don't know where midrashim come from. Do midrashim come from some tradition? Or do Midrashim come because the rabbis sort of like read a little bit here, read a little here, and they come up with their own ideas? If it's tradition, I hold up my hands. It's tradition. Ema lasot. Salach al-Moshe Misinai, Medrash al-Moshe Misinai, right? However, if they came up with it from reading the Pesukim, I've got a better way of reading the Pesukim. Interesting. So he says, Im Svarahi, if it's a Svarah that there are Ananiya Kavod, Im Kabbalahi Nakabel, Im Svarahi, Yesh Devakesh Derech Acher, V'neumar, Ki Yas Samuch Al Har Sinai, Yar Atzei Shittim. I think that near Har Sinai, there was actually a, and this comes back to your theory, right? There was a forest of Atzei Shittim, of acacia trees. Acacia trees are desert trees. Uvavoam Sham, when they came there, Amalahem Shem, Yitakvu Harbe. He told them, by the way, the Ibn Ezra is trying to explain, where did they get the wood for the Mishkan? Okay, where was it? There isn't big planks of wood in the Midbar. So he says, when they got to Har Sinai, and by the way, Har Sinai had a nachal, because we know that when they grinded up the egel, it says, Ela nachal hayored min ahar. And some acacia trees grow by nachalim. Okay, so if there was a nachal, there were trees. Okay, so they knew they were going to stay at Har Sinai. Remember, they get to Har Sinai already in Sivan, it's getting hotter. Okay, they said, Shitakvu sham harbe, ve'en alehem anam kashe perashti. I already explained, there's no anan. It disappeared. Az asakol echad sukkah. So everybody made themselves some sort of hut or shelter. Vanesim asu kidmut chatzerot. And the leaders of the tribes even made them, you know, their own courtyards where they could hold court, right? That's why it's called a courtyard. And kol echad kfi ma'alato. Okay, the kartu kol hayar, they cut down, not very ecological, they cut down the entire forest. Sorry about that. Ki amra vayu, because there are a lot of them. Vasu sukkot, and they actually made sukkot. Umoshe lo diber lahem devar mishkan. They didn't yet know about the mishkan. Rakachar yom kippurim. V'zeitam b'chol hashenim saito. So basically, the Ibn Ezra solved a lot of problems. Number one, the Ibn Ezra rejects the Anan HaYakavod theory. He says, Anan HaYakavod? Who's ever heard of that? I've heard of two Ananim at the most. Okay? And I even think that the really two Ananim are only one. So all we've got is one Anan. Interesting. So that you can't now say, keep a Sukkot or Shabti Ibn Israel. I sat them in Sukkot because there is only one. There aren't seven. Okay? So what do I think? He said, and remember, he says, that you only had the Amud Anan and the Amud Aish when we left Egypt. So I think what happened was they got to Har Sinai, they actually built themselves Sukkot Mamash. He's going with Rabbi Akiva, okay? The Zel, okay? So as I say, I'm much more of a Pshat guy, and even though Ibn Ezra is not written there, I think Sukkot, like you said, Sukkot means a Sukkah, and they must have sat in Sukkot, and there you go. But I am a bit perplexed, because really, was there enough wood for all of them? And then one day, and again, I was quite convinced for many, many years, Anani HaKavod, you know, nice Midrash, but I have to tell you, my relationship to Midrash is a little complicated, because I went to a school, an elementary school, where they taught everything according to the Midrash. And when I got a bit older and started reading Tanakh for myself, I was so confused about Tanakh. Right? Because I mean, to all of the Midrashim, and I was like looking for the Midrashim, and none of them were there, and I really, at about your age, started despising Midrash. Right? It was because everything I'd been taught, and I'm like, it doesn't say it! Like, please! And I felt so, and I had to like relearn everything I learned as a kid. It's actually very good, because then I still knew a lot of Midrashim, and then when I actually learned the Pshat, I was like, that's connected to that. That's what that Midrash was saying. But I had a very anti-Midrash streak, and I was very happy to go with the Ibn Ezra and say, great, Sukkah means a Sukkah. Don't give me any, you know, Midrashic tales about seven Ananim around them, right? Clouds don't flatten mountains, and they don't raise valleys, and nowhere does it say they had this nice little, you know, cozy box, right? They didn't live in one of those glass, you know, Truman Show bubbles where they could, like, all be protected with, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, Anaya Kabod. Sorry, Rabbi Lezer. Doesn't work. And we could end the shiur there, but I have a bit of a problem. That suddenly I started reading the Torah again, and I noticed that they don't, Bnei Israel do not live in Sukkot. They live in tents, which is a bit of a problem. And here's a few examples, okay? When you read in the story of the Egel, the people are living in tents, not in Sukkot. In Dvarim, after Har Sinai, Lech emor lahem, shuva lachem lo'oholechem. So I guess you could say they made a wood frame with like canvas around it or with some sort of animal skins or fabric. I guess you could say. But it always calls them tents. In the story again, in Dvarim Aleph, v'lo avitem la'alot, the story of the Meraglim, You didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael, v'tamru et b'hi Hashem elokeichem, v'tiragnu ba'oleichem, and you murmured in your tents, okay? We have Matovu o'alecha Yaakov, mishkanotecha Yisrael, what Bilam saw, right? They always seem to have tents, right? And I'm like, oh my goodness. Uh-oh. They have tents, right? No one had Sukkot, okay? Uh-oh. So if they weren't living in Sukkot, but they were living in tents, right? Then maybe Arakiv is wrong, and maybe I'm going to have to admit that they really were Anani HaKavod. Oh, shoot, that doesn't really work very well, because it doesn't say anywhere Anani HaKavod, and now I'm really, really stuck, okay? And I'm like trying to figure out, you know, what is in the Torah, right? Torah has this line, but Sukkot HaShavti, but I still don't really understand what they are, okay? So this was when I opened the good old concordance, okay? And this is the good old days when we actually used books and we just didn't use online resources. But if it was nowadays, I just simply open alatorah.org, which I hope you all know about. Everybody know about alatorah? Alatorah is the best resource in the human universe, or in the learning universe anyway. And alatorah, like, basically has an online mikraot gedolot where you can, like, have every parshan you ever wanted in your mikraot gedolot. Like, you can choose. You can, like, curate your own mikraot gedolot. It's a lot of fun. But they also have really great tools. One of them is a concordance. And you can look up a verb and see where it comes up in the Torah. So this is from the Evan Shoshan concordance, okay? And I looked up the verb sakach, okay? Because that's the roots, right? We talk about schach, right? Okay. So what's really interesting is that every single example, almost every single example of the verb sakach seems to be about God either protecting us or something about the Mishkan. Okay? That it's all about God's protection or the coverings of the Mishkan, which of course is, again, Hashem's sukkah, so to speak. Okay? So if you take a look here, we'll just, it's got 19 lines. Let's take a look at a few examples. Okay? V'satukoti kapi alecha adovri. Anybody remember where that is? When Moshe is put in the Nikrata Sela, in the, I don't know what they call it, the nook in the rock, and he says, I'll go past you, I'll cover you, and then when I go past, you'll see my back and you won't see my front. Hilo yirani adam v'chai. I'll put you in the Nikrata Tzur. So he says, V'sakoti kapei alecha. So that's God's, so to speak, cuff, like literally God's hands. God's hands protect us, right? That's really wild. Or Sakota L'Roshi B'Yom Neshek in Tehillim. You protected my head on the day of war. B'Yom Neshek, right? Neshek, you know, means a gun, right? Okay? War. Okay? Or Sakota Ba'af V'Tira Defenu. Okay? This is where God is covering us with anger, but still. Okay? Sakot, by the way, they want two from Eicha here about how God creates a barrier, but it's still God's barrier, but to stop either a barrier of anger or a barrier to stop our prayers coming through, right? In other words, in number four is Sakota banan lacha me'avort tefila. Interestingly, once again, here's a case where sukkah is made out of a cloud. And what does it block? Prayers, okay? Which is very interesting. But now, of course, we have a lot to do with the Mishkan. And of course, the Mishkan is a place. So, for example, number five, Sakota al aronat parochet. You lay the parochet on the Aron. That's where they get the idea that schach can't be any less than 10 tfachim, because that's when you put the kaporet on. It was, or for example, et kruvim shachas sochech, the kruv which creates a canopy, right? And all of that, so the kruvim, once again, in 8 and 9, sochechim become ve'ana kaporet. They make a canopy over the kaporet with their wings. To sucheni beveten imi, you protected, number 12, you protected me in my mother's womb, okay? A lot of them are about the God's protection, God's wings in Tehillim, Tzadi Aleph, number 16, be'evrato yasech lach v'tachat knafav techatzeh in Yoshe b'seite elyon, right? So see, we have this idea of being under God's wings, God's protection, the protection of the kruvim. Or God somehow created a connection out of clouds. Okay, in number 18 from Iyov, Vayasach Elo Ba'ador, Vayasach Bitlatayim Yam. So what do we have this idea that God is actually protecting us? So now we're back to Rabbi Eliezer, right? And actually, the verb sukkah means that we're under God's protection, which is like just a fascinating thought. So really, what's going on here? Now, I really genuinely want to say that I have absolutely no clue what Sukkot they sat in the Midbar, right? Maybe they actually sat in tents. And maybe they had an Amud Anan, maybe as a sign over them, or occasionally to protect them from the heat or from the sun, and occasionally worked as a sort of a boomerang for various weaponry that was being shot at them, right? But when Hashem says, B'sukot hoshavti b'nei Yisrael, what I want to argue is that it's trying to say something about the relationship with Am Yisrael. And here, let's try and look at the famous Rashbam, which, have you learned this Rashbam today? You've been doing a lot of Sukkah stuff? No? All right, this is pretty much the most famous Rashbam that is the basis of Sukkot. So I always like doing very central Makorot. So everyone's saying, you know the Rashbam on Sukkot? And your men are like, say, sure. So this is it. Okay, this is it, we're going to learn it, right? So that you can like do that head nod and like say, yeah, I know that one, yeah.
Does it mean that they lived in tents, but because God was protecting them, their tents
were also okay, so then, in other words, what we're really saying is, Basakot HaShavti is not the physical, right? Maybe they weren't on an Ekavod, maybe they also were only tents, and they weren't in a Sukkah. But it talks about Hashem protecting them. Hashem was, where else did we get food? We got it from the man. Where else did we get water? There was some sort of be'er, or he led us to places where there would be water, right? Al ne'im anuchot yina haleni, right? Or, in other words, God was really looking after us, right? We'll see it in a minute, okay? In Devarim Perachet, which is going to be the critical text for the Rashbam, okay? So, so let's try and understand now. We always have this question, okay, if we're meant to be remembering the wilderness years, when should Sukkot be? When should we sit in the Sukkah? Pesach, right? So what do people always say?
Too many holidays close to
each other. but now we've got too many holidays, right? In other words, what do people always say? Why do we have Sukkot now?
So that like we feel more uncomfortable.
Why do we feel more comfortable now? Right. So the thing is, like, if you live anywhere else in Israel, it's actually pretty hot in the Sukkah. Like, I used to learn that when I was in London. Now, in London, I used to sit with a coat in the Sukkah or with, like, a heater. It was, like, really cold. The first year I came back from Yeshiva, I wanted to be really religious, so I told my parents I was going to, like I did in Israel, I'm going to sleep in the Sukkah, right? I couldn't sleep in the Sukkah. It was so freezing. And anyway, it rains every 2 minutes in London. Yeah, and it was even worse than that. I couldn't even sit and learn in the Sukkah. It was, like, so uncomfortable, right? So it's great. There's this idea that we sit in the Sukkah because it gets cold and it's a test for you. But it's actually a lovely time in the year to set out in the Sukkah here, especially in Yerushalayim. If you're going to be in Eilat, it might not be so comfortable. But Tel Aviv, it's not always so comfortable in the middle of the day. But Yerushalayim, it's gorgeous. It's the best time. So that doesn't work. It's not really that much of a test, you know. So let's take a look. Right? By the way, if the Rashbam has to vote, okay, Rashbam, by the way, you all know who the Rashbam is, Rashi's grandson, again, one of the Pashtanim, okay? Rashi, more often than not, brings Midrashim, okay? He sometimes will take the most Pshat Midrash, but Rashi is not a Pashtan, right? Rashi is really interested in interpreting the innuendos of Psukim according to the traditional way of interpreting things, okay? But two of our very early Pashtanim would be the Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam. The Rashbam even has a Rashbam at the beginning of Vayeshev, where he talks about how he, you know, sat with his grandfather and says, you know, Saba, why do you explain it like that? And he said, Rashi even said to me, you know, if I had time, I'd write a different Perush, okay? I'd write a Pshat Perush, but I didn't have time. I'm too busy writing on Shas. So let's take a look at the Rashbam. The Rashbam here, okay, Pshuto. The explanation that I prefer is Kedivei Arim b'Masechet Sukkah, Sukkah Mamash. He says, I go with Rabbi Akiva, right? I also not so into Ananei HaKavod, just like the Ibn Ezra. V'zeh shel davar, Chag HaSukkot Tselecha Bo'os Pachag Arnachal Miyikvecha. So he says, why is Sukkot now? He says, because this is the time when you gather in everything from your goren, right? A goren is your threshing floor, Umiyikvecha. Yekev is a winery, okay? It's an ingathering. It's like, you know, like in a month or two, the Americans are going to have a chag called Thanksgiving, right? And when do they give? This is the Jewish Thanksgiving, okay? Because this is the ingathering, when you take in not only your sweet potatoes and whatever it is, but we took in the Shiva Minim, okay? By the way, if you know the, you know, people think that the Bikurim, were brought on. What's Chag HaBikurim? Shavuot, okay? But actually, you've got to understand that in Israel, you did not bring fruits on Shavuot. All you brought was the Bikurim, the first fruits from your barley harvest and your wheat harvest, right? Barley harvest is Pesach, the wheat harvest is Shavuot, okay? Over the summer, the fruits ripen, okay? So, for example, you will see, I sort of know a little bit about this because I'm very lucky that I have half of the Shiva Minim in my garden, okay? So, for example, I have a pomegranate tree, and guess when pomegranates become ripe? Now, right? And my fig tree has been getting ripe and producing figs pretty much all the way through July, August. I use succulent, because actually the agricultural cycle is according to the solar cycle, not the lunar cycle, right? And the grapes, I know that always the last week of August I have to pick my grapes or else they actually start dripping with grape juice because they literally burst. And so you have to do them by then. And just now, my olives are ready, right? So all the fruits are ready at the end of the summer. And at the end of the summer, the farmer is going to feel really great about life because he knows, truth is, he might... Oh, beautiful. Okay, so the truth is, this really explains as well why Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is there, because the idea is like this. Right now, every farmer knows how rich he is for the next 6 months. He's gonna take all his fruits. They took dates and figs and they dried them, right? And raisins and whatever it is, and they dried them, and that was their sugar for the winter, right? And they had their wheat, and that was their bread for the winter, right? And their oil, right? And everything else. And their barn was totally full. And that's why it's Zman Simchatenu, because we're so happy, because basically you got like five paychecks just now, okay? But that's gonna keep you through the winter, right? Now, let's say, by the way, you didn't do so well. So that's why around this time of year, which is the end of an agricultural cycle and the beginning of the next one, you're like spending this month saying, oh gosh, how can I be a better farmer? I've got to buy fertilizer. And they told me that I should plow the field before I do this, right? So what's this? It's time of looking back at the year and doing an assessment, doing a cheshbon nefesh, and both praying to God that there'll be rain for the next year, and also doing like tshuva, right? Say to yourself, how am I going to be different next year? So what's true about agriculture? That's why now is Rosh Hashanah, right? Because it's the Rosh Hashanah, the agricultural Rosh Hashanah. That's why Chazal say that your parnas is decided now, because this is the changeover. Everything we've done until now is done. There's nothing you can do to give yourself a bigger paycheck, right? Now, okay? Whatever you've done this, but you can think about next year, you can be a better farmer next year, right? And what we then do is we say, oh, the same thing that's happening in terms of your finances, in terms of your farm, is also going to be in terms of your spiritual, right? Because, of course, if you don't have any food, you die, right? You know, your children won't have anything to eat, okay? So this is a really case of mi yichyeh mi yamut, right? It's not something simple. You know, there's no welfare, right? Well, there is. We have tzedakah, but you've got to be lucky to get that, right? So this is why this is so. But if you've done well, this is a great time of year. You're happy. You're willing to share, right? Because you just feel like everything's in abundance. So here we go. Chag HaSukkot Tzaselecha Bo'ospecha Garnecha Miyukrei. When you gather in your wheat and your wine, Bo'ospecha Tzvod Haaretz. And you're full of grain and tirosh. Tirosh is wine, yitzhar, oil. So you've got to remember that Bnei Israel lived in the Midbar. I put them in the Midbar for 40 years. Below Yishuv, they didn't have land. You're in Eretz Israel. Who gave you this land? Who gave you this bounty? Who gave you this fertile land? It's incredible, right? Land produces all these gorgeous fruits. Who gave you this? Hashem. Batim Maleim Kol Tov. Al Tamru Bevalchem Kochi Ve'osim Yedi Asali Et HaChayel Hazeh. Okay? And now he's going to say, and this is what it says in Parshat Ekev. So, you know what? Let's just look at Parshat Ekev. Okay? So, you will see it in number 8. Okay? Let's just read this a little bit. We've got 3 minutes. Okay? It says like this. We're going to read Parshat Ekev, Devarim Perek Chet. If you can look at it in your Tanakh if you want, or just here. In fact, I'm going to look at it in my Tanakh. Okay? It says like this. כל המצווה אשר אנוכי מצווך היום תשכרו לעשות למען תחיון ורביתם ובאתם וירשתם את הארץ אשר נשבע השם לאבותיכם. So do all the mitzvot, because that'll be the key to holding on to the land. וזכרת. And remember, את הדרך אשר הוליכה השם אלוקיך זה 40 שנה במדבר. Remember how you went 40 years in the midbar, למען ענותך, לנסותך, לדעת את אשר בלבבך, התשמור מצוותיו אם לא. Okay? In order to test you, right? So that you should... It was to test what you're really made of. But now look at this. Pasuk Gimel. Ve'ancha ve'erivecha ve'alchicha taman. In the midbar you were hungry, right? And God gave you the man, asher lo yadata, this magical food, ve'lo yadun avatecha. Leman adiachas, you should know, ki lo alechem levado yichya adam, ki al kol motzei pi Hashem tichya adam. So, yichya adam. So the idea being, right? Simlat chalo baltame alecha. Your clothes didn't wear out. Raglecha lo bateka. Right? Your feet didn't get all parched from the heat. Zerbaim Shana. And basically, then he says, Pasuk Zayin, Ki Hashem Elokecha Meviyacha Eretz Tova. God's going to bring you into land, Eretz Nachalei Mayim. To a natural land with rivers, Ayanotu Tomot Yusim Bebekavahar, and springs, Eretz Chital, Sorav, Gevem, Metenau, Rimon, Eretz Zeh Shem Adudvash, Eretz Hashelo B'miskunut Tuchal Balechem, it won't be difficult to eat bread, Lo Techsar Choba, Eretz Hashav, Anei Barzel, Meharei Techzon Mechoshet, Ve'achalta B'savata, and so when you eat, you should bless God for the good land. Right, not for the food, for the land. Right, but what's the danger? Pasuk Yudalef, Hisham lecha pentishkach Hashem lokecha. You're going to forget God. Levilti shemor mitzvotav. Why? Because what's it going to tell you is this. Look at the next pasuk. Pasuk Yudalef, pentochal, because you'll eat v'savata uvatim tovim tirei shafta. You're going to get very rich. Uvakarachav v'tomcha yirbon yon. You'll have lots of livestock. V'chesav v'zahav yirbalach. V'chol hashelach yirbe. V'ram levavchan. You'll get all proud. V'shachakter Hashem lokecha. You'll say, who made all this wealth? I did. Right. And what will you say? You will turn around and you'll say, look at Pasuk Yud Zayin. Kochi va'otzim yadi asalei zechar hazeh. I'm the one who made the farm work so well. I did it, right? V'zachar den Hashem elokecha, ki hu anoten lecha koch lasot chayim. Now, the idea here is basically saying, why do we leave our nice homes, right? We've got, Baruch Hashem, lovely homes. Why do we leave our home and go and sit outside, right, in a hut? I don't know whether Hashem put us in these huts, right? First of all, we do this thing, it's a sukkah, and it's got schach, and of course, schach is the most very important halachic requirement, because what we're actually saying is, we want to be under God's protection, right? We want to be under God's protection. And if you want to also go with the fact that sukkah is so associated with the kruvim, right? We actually want to put ourselves in an intimate relationship with God. We want to live in God, like we say, ki es benenim sukko b'yom ra'ah, yastireni b'seita olo, b'sur yirom ameni, right? We're saying, l'dabal Hashem ori v'yishi, I feel safe because of God. And so we actually want to say a lot of statements by going out of a house that you're this time of year, right? And you're feeling so wealthy, you're feeling so secure, you're feeling so smug, you're feeling so. And what do? We go outside. It's, by the way, it's gorgeous, but we sit in this halakhically mandated hut, and we know we have to sit there. We can't sit in our homes. We can't sleep in our homes. By the way, it's very special to sleep in the sukkah, to eat in the sukkah. We move in out. We move our laptops into the sukkah and everything into the sukkah. We literally live in our sukkah for we actually have two sukkahs, sleeping sukkah upstairs and a living sukkah downstairs, right? And we really take sukkahs very seriously in our house. And when you live in the sukkah, it's like a really, Judaism does these like, you know, simulation games, right? Where like we turn over our whole cuisine and our kitchen for a week at Pesach time, and then we turn over our whole home, right? And the idea is you spend a week with God, right, in the sukkah, saying, you know, there's just this thin membrane protecting me from God, protecting me from the elements, right? And what is it trying to remind us? It's not all about you. That your wealth, and it is your wealth, but your wealth comes from God, okay? Your wealth comes from God. And it's to have that feeling of insecurity. Now, it could well be that this year, we haven't needed to feel insecurity because we all feel insecure completely anyway, right? Because of the war and because of anti-Semitism around the world. But in an average year, right, we go about our lives. We don't think about anything, right? And suddenly this insecurity comes very powerfully. I just want to do something. I'm sorry. I just want to do one tiny thing which relates to halacha, right? But I just want to show very, very, very quickly, okay? The sukkah, okay? How much does it need to enclose you?
What?
How much does it need to enclose you, the sukkah?
Three walls.
Okay? We need three walls. Okay? Can you have two walls? Two, you can't have. Okay? You can have four, but it's going to have at least three or two and a bit walls. Okay? All right, great. What? But even so, even if you can have four walls, okay, you still need to have a pervious roof, right? Okay? Okay. So, all right. I'll get to explain all that. Okay. The schach, okay? The schach. Can the schach be attached to the ground?
No.
No. Okay? It can't be attached to the ground. So you can't do that. Does it have to be made from natural material? Yes, it needs to be made from natural material, but it needs to be detached, right? Okay? That's interesting. Okay? Okay, could I take this table and make... Let's say this table was actually made out of wood and not made out of plastic. Could I use this on my sukkah?
No.
No, why?
It has to be made for the
sukkah, no? Maybe, although you could put it out there. You're not allowed something which is mekabel tuma, okay? You're not allowed something which is mekabel tuma, right? What is being mekabel tuma? Anything which is processed as a household object is not allowed to be used, okay? What I really want to say, and this is part of a whole other halachic shir, and I've gone over time, and I apologize. Is this okay? We could say it like what I really want to do is this. Where's this? Okay, I want to say it like this. Okay. You have exposed. Some people think that sukkah is a nature holiday, right? We go, we take some like leaves and fruits and we shake them around. That sounds very hipster, right? And then we sit in a hut, you know, with like greenery all around, right? But all I need to do is, you know, light up and it'll all be great. Okay, so now, that's not what it's about, okay? What I want to say is that you've got, always going to be in a halfway house between exposed and fully protected. We go out of our houses where we've got our protection, okay? We also are somewhere between natural, we can't have it connected, and we can't have it too processed, okay? If it's too processed, if it's mekabel tuma, it doesn't work, okay? So we are somewhere in the middle of all of that, or manufactured, right? And the idea is what God's really trying... That's not allowed, and that's not allowed. Okay? And what we're actually saying is we're creating an environment where we're somehow in the middle of these two different things. Okay? We're in a temporary dwelling. It has to be somewhere... It has to be a dwelling. But if it's too permanent, then it's a dira a keva. But if it's not a dira, it doesn't work. So it has to be arai, right? You know, so you need a if it's keva, that's no good, okay? If it's not a dira, that's no good. We want it to be a arai, okay? Arai means temporary, okay? And what I want to say is, what it's really trying to do, and that's the whole Kohelet thing as well, right? It's trying to talk about the fact that we shouldn't be so secure, okay? That we have a tendency, especially in our age where we have, you know, we have air conditioning and we have, you know, we don't live in leaky homes anymore and we have good careers and we're pretty sure that we're going to go ahead in life and we're going to have money and we're going to have success and we're going to have, and we build ourselves to be impervious. What we always want is to be able to secure everything. We get shocked if there's something which, like, when COVID came along, we're like, whoa, right? So it's true that we had a lot of, like, insecurity lately between COVID and the last year in Israel. But what Sukkot is trying to do is to tap into this, right? And to channel it. And it says, okay, you know what? Where are you going to take protection? Hashem. Where do you get your strength? From Hashem. Okay? And that is the Hoshavti. The Hoshavti is, if you want, sitting in the protection of God. Okay? So that, we will leave it there. And I'll wish you all a chag sameach.
She said, I know this year, she's married.